Hello again and welcome back. St. Louis had a reputation as a good labor town for decades. There were many thousands of union members here, the Teamsters, United Auto Workers, Aerospace, and other unions. But union membership has been dwindling here and all over the country. With me in studio to talk about where organized labor is and where it's going is author-historian Jefferson Cowie. He teaches courses on labor relations, law, and history at Cornell University. His most recent book is Stayin' Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. His writing is the inspiration for the latest production at the Rep here, Soups, Stews, and Casseroles, 1976, which runs through the 30th at the Rep. Jefferson Cowie, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is happening to unions today in this country? I said they're dwindling, and they surely are.
Yeah, well, they don't continue to dwindle. They sort of leveled off at around union density of about 6%, which is historically extraordinarily low. That's back – takes us all the way back to the days before the Wagner Act, before the New Deal, any of that stuff. So it's very, very bad.
If I remember correctly, it wasn't too many years ago. It was around 30%, 31, 32%.
The height was 35 in the mid-50s.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
And it's still high in the public sector. As you've seen in Wisconsin and other places, the public sector is under attack as well.
Why are the numbers going down so much?
That is a big question. there are as many explanations as there are angles on that question. There are political factors, economic factors, cultural issues, organizational problems with organized labor. There's enough blame to go around for this question.
But there seems to be, maybe this is too strong a word, almost an assault on unions. Yeah. I mean, we see it in the political world. I mean, governors all over the country are coming down hard, primarily because of the pension issues, I guess.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say primarily. I mean, there's been an assault on labor since the mid-70s. I mean, that's really when it began. And that's one of the key themes of the book. Labor has basically been playing defense since the early 1980s, and they've been unable to sort of find some traction, some ground on which to stand to fight off this attack. And you're right, it has been an attack. But also at the same time, and any organizer knows, they have a big enemy. They have to be prepared to take it on. And you can't just play victim. You have to actually get out there and do something about it, and they haven't been able to find that method or that tactic.
Well, one of the things they'd always traditionally been able to do is go out and vote and organize, but with the numbers down as low as they are, they don't have that muscle that we're used to seeing.
Right. They still have a great impact in the financing of elections, obviously. They're still one of the core economic forces within the Democratic Party and the occasional Republican, not that many. But in terms of those old days where they ran the get out the vote efforts, they had the phone banks, they had the members, they had all the connections with the aldermen and the urban machines. Those are gone.
Yeah, people don't often remember that when Citizens United was decided by the Supreme Court declaring that corporations are people, they threw labor unions into that mix as well. So they fall under that umbrella also.
Yeah, which created a certain tension within labor's response to that as well. Yeah. Because on the one hand, they'd love to see corporations curtailed in that, but they don't want to see themselves curtailed at the same time.
Yeah. How about President Reagan's move against PATCO back, I guess, in the early 80s it was? How much of an influence do you think that had on the diminished role of labor unions?
Yeah, Paul Volcker said it was the most important thing that the Reagan administration did. It set the tone. It set the tenor. It set signals to the private sector on how they could deal with labor relations in the 1980s. But I also see that more as the culmination of a series of changes that happened in the 1970s. Gears had already been turning toward that moment in the summer of 1981 where Reagan fired the 13,000 members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. And I think that was a symptom of the sort of – rather than the beginning of the end, that was really – sort of the culmination of a whole series of defeats for organized labor in the 1970s.
And the impact of this change, this dynamic, has meant what for this country? I know the middle class is something that is pointed to time and time again as a group, if you will, that is losing as a result of the lesser union presence.
Yeah, you're seeing a hollowing out of the economic center of the country. Inequality. Well, let me back up for a second. If you go back to the 1970s again, the most equal point on the graph where the top of the economy and the bottom of the economy were closest together was around 1972. Mm-hmm. And then the top and the bottom began to separate until now you have this astronomical levels of inequality. Well, part of that is wages have stagnated for working people. I mean, they really have not gone up since the 70s. The minimum wage has gone down in real terms. And so without bargaining power in some capacity, whether it's social, political, or through serious collective bargaining and unions at the bargaining table, there's no way for people to sort of address this issue of inequality. Mm-hmm. And inequality is the defining issue of our day, I think. And we tend to think of it as, oh, isn't that sad? But actually, there's an entire set of cultural, social issues that connect with that. We now know from public health studies that homicide rates are higher in unequal countries. Incarceration rates are higher in unequal countries. Education is worse. People are happier in more equal countries. People live longer in more equal countries. Mm-hmm. And even the rich live longer in more equal countries. So the more we've polarized ourselves, the more we've increased anxiety and stress and overwork and all of these things that are really tearing at the social fabric.
And, of course, it's costing government a lot more money because it's having to pay for social programs to help these people get on their feet economically.
Yeah, and I mean, and we saw that in the fast food strikes and things like this where news came out that you know, McDonald's was sending their employees to training them on how to get food stamps and things like this. And studies have been done on how much it costs to support Walmart workers in California through public subsidies mm-hmm. and things like this. So this is a social issue, a national issue, and it needs a national conversation.
What specifically was happening in the 70s? When I think of the 70s, I think of Watergate primarily and the end of the Vietnam War. But what else was happening to cause this this change?
Yeah, it was more than Watergate, more than Vietnam, more than bad fashion.
Give us the Bee Gees.
So right. And actually, the book is named after a Bee Gees song, Stayin' Alive.
That's what I figured.
Right? And the one thing we often don't hear in that sort of helium falsetto song of theirs is the lyrics say, "Life's going nowhere. Somebody help me. I'm staying alive." Mm-hmm. There's sort of a cry for help in that song. And then it says, "But it's okay. You can look the other way." And there's a sense, a sort of an inversion of everything that happened in the 30s. You think of the 30s and the decade of the common man and things. That song is literally inviting you to say, forget it. It's okay. Mm-hmm. You don't have to even think about this, even though it's a problem. So, and we see that throughout actually popular culture, whether it's Springsteen or, you know, country and western songs or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of that sort of attitude. But economically, you see a shift from the country having a strong industrial base towards service and finance. That has a major impact. Politics begins to shift from sort of that model we were just talking about where the economic interests of working people were what the Democratic Party serviced to more cultural values. And you really see that with Richard Nixon where he begins to sort of shift the working class vote more towards cultural values and away from economic interests. Mm-hmm. In fact, after he wins in 72, he says, "Culture matters. If it was just economics, they would have voted for McGovern." Mm-hmm. And so that happens. At the same time, the AFL-CIO and the constituent unions, we have to remember the AFL-CIO is a federation of mm-hmm. unions, is facing insurgencies within the labor movement that are saying, hey, we need to take the environment seriously. We need to take women's issues seriously, civil rights seriously, all these things. But there are some very conservative movements within the AFL-CIO that are trying to block McGovern, that are trying to prevent any changes within the union. And they sort of think they won the game and they don't need to change. And so they're a little afraid of of changing things. So while all these transformations are going on in the United States at the same time, organized labor can't really find a way to take advantage of the social movements of the 60s, blend those with the old class movements of the 70s, and try and advance the cause. They sort of miss that moment.
Is this something the so-called 1% has been kind of pushing along?
Yeah, I think very much so. As a, and I mean, this creates the 1%. I mean, the tax rates have, you know, been very generous to them. The amount of money in the financial sector is just extraordinary. And I think if that money were redistributed into the pockets of working people, so they could actually buy things instead of just allowing people to experiment with the financial models that are irresponsible, I think we'd be a lot better off. Yeah.
I want to encourage and invite members of our listening audience to get into the conversation. You can give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Let's bring in Dennis calling from University City. Dennis, thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air with Jeff Cowie.
Hi, Don. This is Dennis. You know me.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to bring up previous events. University of New South Wales, Alex Carey, making democracy safe for business, starting in 1912. And then the foundation for crushing unions was really enacted, I believe, in 1948 with the Taft-Hartley Act. And as I just heard on, as you guys were chatting, the concentration of wealth in the financial sector, and that was actually a Ronald Reagan policy. And then how about a minimum wage of $4 an hour for the Chinese workers? There would have been no financial collapse. So please comment, gentlemen. It's
all
wonderful
right
to hear your show.
Thanks, Dennis.
Well, I think the caller mentions the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, and which curtailed labor's strength after the Wagner Act of 1935. A lot of people point to that moment as the moment that the game was already lost. And I think it was certainly contained. Organized labor was very contained within very specific parameters in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. But I think there was still a great deal of latitude for labor to act and to grow and to think about the service sector and other areas that they could have done some organizing in, but didn't. Organized labor has always been restrained, circumscribed in the United States context. But I think if there was a moment, it was accepting Taft-Hartley and moving on.
The $4 an hour for Chinese workers, I guess, is a reference to what the people in China make, mm-hmm. and that's why a lot of the things that we buy are made in China. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And the so-called labor question, as it used to be called back in the progressive era, what do we do about workers? What do they deserve? It is burning and alive in China. And I think we're going to see a lot of interest and a lot of social movement going on in China. We already do. A lot of it doesn't get reported. But I think there's a lot of excitement that's going to happen in China around that issue.
Let's take an email from Madonna. How much of the drop in union membership in St. Louis is due to systemic attrition, and how much is due to changes in the legal structure, i.e. right to work, banning automatic deduction of union dues, non-mandatory membership, et cetera, instituted by conservative legislators?
That's a great question. Is how much of this is structure and how much of this is actually the problems of unions themselves? From my perspective, from that apex in 1955 of 35%, all industry was already beginning to decline at that point. By the early 60s, automation, decentralization of industry, things like that are going on. And if people were smart at that point, they would have seen the writing on the walls and realized, okay, we need to move beyond the core industrial sectors, steel, auto, glass, electrical, those things, those great sort of white male lunch bucket kind of industries. But it didn't happen. And then when it was ready to happen, especially in the 70s, when there was more people of color, more women, more service sector occupations, by then the legal climate had changed dramatically. And it was very difficult to organize a union by then. And Carter tried to institute changes to the National Labor Relations Act in 1978, and that went down for lack of two votes in a filibuster.
Mm. But what's the future of unions, do you think?
The future of unions is a very difficult thing to predict. I mean, the Chattanooga vote, which your listeners may be familiar with, in which the United Auto Workers looked like they were going to win a victory at the first so-called Southern Transplant, which is a foreign-owned auto plant in the South, just recently took place. And but they lost. They lost by – had 46 votes switched the other way. They would have had the United Auto Workers representing those workers at the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga. And what's interesting about that, though, is it's not just that – they lost, but actually it was pretty clear not only was Volkswagen neutral, they winked that they wanted a union because they were interested in a German-style works council there where workers actually participated in management discussions. The workers there said no. And if you want to look on the bright side, you can look at – well, there's a big – If you want to look at one side, there was a very big conservative publicity operation to try and change workers' minds in Chattanooga. But on the other side, you have to look at that and wonder, wow, if you cannot win when management is neutral to sympathetic, when are we going to win? It's very disturbing. Then the next question becomes, okay, if labor is not going to bounce back, what are the other mechanisms we can begin to think about that might address these issues of inequality?
And what might they be?
Well, there's a variety. You know, not everybody has high union density. There's other forms of social responsibility. You know, France, for instance, has, you know, we're not going to be France, but there are different models in which there's a low union density but high social movement dimension where they will put a lot of social pressure on people. Or Japan, where inequality is nowhere near as high as it is here because of a cultural value that says, no, we don't believe in that. There are other possibilities where we could actually, in the case of Volkswagen, they didn't necessarily have to have a union in order to be in that plant, except legally they did in order to have that works council because the laws prevent company unions in the United States. So there could be some changes to the law to create more flexibility around that, to create different sort of occupational cultures. So the bottom line is there is no easy way out of this one.
Right. Let's take a couple of calls as time allows. There's some good questions coming at us. We'll start with Charles in St. Louis City. Go ahead, Charles. Question or comment, please.
Yes. My question is, haven't the unions become all too polite with regarding strikes? Perhaps they should start, like especially fast food restaurants, workplace sabotage and basically hold the companies kind of hostage to get pay raises? I'll take my answer off it.
Wants to go back to the 30s, maybe. Huh?
Yeah. You know, there has been a tradition of sabotage in this country. The industrial workers of the world in the first two decades of the 20th century. There was some in the 1970s in some of the auto plants and things like this. But by and large, I think unions feel they're in a fragile position in terms of their public relations, and that if they overstep certain boundaries, they're going to get hit pretty hard. Now, that doesn't mean they can't be more aggressive with use of, you know, walkouts and strikes and things like this. Unfortunately, the strike in the United States has become all but illegal with striker replacement. If you walk out, you can be legally replaced, and that creates a big, big obstacle. So the social and the legal climate on that question is really difficult.
Jacob in Manchester, go ahead. You're on the air with Jeff Cowie.
Hi. You know, there's been a lot of talk lately on the news about raising the minimum wage, and I was wondering if your guests would have a comment, because I've been noticing a lot of people have been talking about raising the minimum wage, but that would not increase unemployment. But I don't understand how, with labor being something that's bought and sold and responds to supply and demand, how raising wages would not affect minimum wage.
This is a big debate in economic circles. I think the evidence is that raising the minimum wage does have a relatively minor effect on the unemployment rate, a negative effect. And so you do run a certain risk. That said, the minimum wage is at historical lows. During some of the great economies of the post-war period, the minimum wage was much higher and the tax rates were much higher. And it was a shared economy. if you put money in the hands of working people, they will spend it. They won't hoard it. And it's, you know, the job creators are those who have wages. They are not the rich who are can only buy so many yachts and so many nice cars.
Yeah, the job creators are sitting on so much cash right now in corporate America. They could solve a lot of problems, but they'd release some of it, couldn't they?
That's exactly right.
Let's bring in Eric calling from St. Louis. Eric, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, you're talking about greater equality as being the goal, and I think of one avenue as trying to increase the chances of small proprietorships. And you mentioned the 60s missing the boat, the unions missing the boat in the 60s. What about, do you think an opportunity was lost when unions didn't, say, combine forces with the small is beautiful movement, leading towards a smaller scale of everything? Right now we have huge scale, big business versus big faceless unions, and everything seems to get bigger and more impersonal and more faceless. What about a smaller, more human-scaled economy? And if you go back, you know, 30 or 40 years before that time period, there was a big debate in England about that, over distributism versus large-scale socialism versus big industry. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, one problem we see is especially unions organizing in particularly small enterprises is they can drag down the small enterprises. So, for instance, if you go and you organize the mom-and-pop video store while Blockbuster down the street isn't, you're going to put that smaller firm at risk vis-a-vis the larger competition. Works in retail all over the place. So I think organized labor needs to go after the larger employees, the Walmarts and things like that. But the future, I think, probably belongs to the types of enterprises you're talking about. And for my argument, sort of balancing the small and the large is probably the way to go. So, for instance, I think probably the single best thing you could do to unleash all the entrepreneurial energy in this country, whether you want, no matter what you want to do, would be healthcare. If you knew you were going to get your healthcare from someplace, you would be more likely to leave your job and go try that. But if you are tied to your big employer because that's the only place you can get healthcare, you know, what else are you going to do? So and so the unions do that, and they advocate for that, and I think that's an important step.
We only have about a minute left. What about union leadership? I mean, we can look back to the days of the Jimmy Hoffas and the Walter Ruthers, mm-hmm. and a number of other names would come to mind. They were out there. They were tough. They were outspoken, and they were leaders. Do we have those people in those positions today?
You know, I'm actually a pretty big fan of Rich Trumka, who's the current president of the AFL-CIO. I think he's a pretty impressive guy, and I think he has a way of framing complicated issues in a pretty populist way. Unfortunately, nobody's listening, you know, or few outside the labor circles are really listening. He doesn't have that bully pulpit.
They don't get the kind of coverage that the others used to get.
Yeah. There used to be a labor beat with every paper. Right. You know, there was a guy who covered organized labor. Now, you know, there's Steve Greenhouse of the New York Times, and that's pretty much what we have.
All right. Well, Jeff Cowie, thanks so much for being with us. I'll tell folks that you'll be participating in a panel discussion at Webster University's library at 4 o'clock this afternoon. If folks want to hear more of this kind of discussion, it is open to all. And by the way, the play that you helped inspire, Soups, Stews, and Casseroles 1976, will be running all through the rest of this month, through the 30th, I believe, at the Rep Theater, also at Webster.
Marvelous play. Really get everybody to go out and see it.
Well, look who inspired it. Jeff Cowie, thanks so much for being with us. Enjoy your stay in St. Louis.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with writer Dave Barry about his new collection of humorous essays on parenting. And believe me, folks, he's very, very funny in this one. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.